CMC Markets is a pioneering CFD and spread betting provider. With more than 30 years of experience, CMC Markets provides traders with the tools they need to trade confidently. 76% of retail investor accounts lose money.
Welcome to the City View podcast in partnership with CMC Markets. I'm Andy Sylvester, acting editor of City AM, and we'll launch right into the news, analysis, and interviews that you need for the week ahead in the city. Hello and welcome to the City View podcast in partnership with CMC Markets. I'm Andy Sylvester, acting editor at City AM. Well, what a week it was in the rearview mirror. Not only did we have the ongoing battle between a Reddit army and Wall Street's institutional investors, but the Bank of England essentially telling UK commercial banks, if you read the small print, it might want to start pondering the impact of negative interest rates. Shell followed BP with horrendous results, both battered by the impact of the pandemic on oil demand. All eyes will be on the former's boss this coming week when he sets out the plan for the firm to enter a brave new greener future. Can it continue to deliver the dividends that investors have loved forever? And two reviews were dangled to the press. We expect the Ron Khalifa review on fintechs to come out this week, with plans for the UK to become a world leader, perhaps turning some of our exciting challengers into globally focused unicorns, whilst the review into audit firms looks set to see fines on individuals for the first time. That comes after the sector has been the subject of plenty of bad headlines after failings on firms from Carillion to BHS. But the biggest news of the week, perhaps? That Jeff Bezos is set to vacate the big chair at Amazon, moving on from CEO to the uniquely American post of executive chair. He wants to spend more time on his other projects, be it getting us to space, the Washington Post, or his Oceans Foundation. Andy Jassy, the brains behind the firm's web services division, will take charge, perhaps signalling that the retailer may be starting to think long-term about how to diversify what it does, and indeed where it makes its money. One senses that Jassy may start dreading early morning emails from one jbezos at amazon.com. I'll be joined in a few minutes by Emma McClarkin, the boss of the British Beer and Pub Association, but first here's Michael Hewson, chief market analyst at CMC Markets, to take us through the week to come. So with one week in the rearview mirror, we'll now look at the week ahead. I'm delighted as ever to be joined by Michael Hewson, Chief Markets Analyst at CMC Markets. Michael, thanks for coming on.
Yes, good afternoon, good evening, or whatever. I don't know. We want to do that again.
Indeed, we're allowing anyone to listen whenever we want. This week, all eyes probably on Friday morning. Q4 UK GDP, we saw the Bank of England this week hold steady. But yeah, it'll be the first sort of big economic indicators of what lockdown light looks like, I suppose, November, December.
Yeah, and it's actually quite strange, Andy, because the pound's had another decent week this week. It's hit an 8-month high against the euro. The Bank of England, as you may recall, left rates unchanged. But I think what was quite notable was the fact they ruled out the prospect of negative rates in the short term. They've kept the possibility on the table, giving banks 6 months to try and adapt to them. But the fact of the matter is, if we need negative rates in 6 months, then, you know, we're in a lot of trouble, because that would suggest that the vaccine rollout's not going as expected and lockdown restrictions haven't been eased. So I think in the context of fourth quarter GDP, you're right, it should give us an indication as to how lockdown light, which obviously started at the beginning of November, will have affected the UK economy. The Bank of England is already very pessimistic about the first quarter of this year. They've downgraded their growth forecast to minus 4%. So I think even if we do get a contraction in Q4, you'll get all of these headlines about, you know, double dip recession, what have you. But I think that rather misses the point. I think the fact of the matter is we got a fairly decent Q3 and expansion of 16%. And actually, I think Q4 could well actually perform a little bit better than what people are expecting. I think there is an expectation we could get a negative quarter. But I think there are a number of factors that might actually see us avoid a negative print. One of which is obviously the retail sector. Obviously, that's had a very, or should I say consumer spending. I think we need to separate the two, consumer spending as opposed to high street retail. So we'll look at high street retail. Obviously, we had a little bit of a surge prior to the original November tiering as people tried to get ahead of the semi-lockdown. Then we had a minor easing at the beginning of December before more stringent regulations in the middle of December. So I think those consumer boosts might have actually added to the overall sum of GDP, but also manufacturing and construction has actually performed fairly well. You've also got the small matter of the expiry of the Brexit transition period. Now, there was an awful lot of stories about logistical problems at ports, and an awful lot of that was as a result of retailers and businesses stockpiling goods ahead of the Christmas period in the event they might run out. So that actually could act as a net positive for fourth quarter GDP. So the expectations are anything between 0.5% and minus 0.5%. But if we come in the right side of that, then we could avoid a double dip.
Yeah, which of course, you know, doesn't necessarily change the outlook for this year, which is all going to come around to how quickly we can get jabs in arms, really.
I think that's the key thing, Andy, about how quickly we can reopen. Q1's a write-off. I think we can agree about that. And really, it's a question of how quickly restrictions get eased from April and how well the vaccine rollout goes. And if it goes according to plan, then we could see a significant rebound in Q2 and potentially Q3.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely true. And speaking of vaccines, AstraZeneca, a company who were in the news sort of 2-3 years ago, all sorts of tie-ups with Pfizer, became a bit of a political football. Now in the news for very different reasons, an almighty row with the European Commission, which I think is more the fault of the political body than the corporate one. But we got an update from them this week.
Yeah, I mean, big pharma's usually fairly boring. It's fairly stable. They pay decent dividends, and generally they tend to have a fairly low profile. In recent years, some sectors of that particular sector have come in for criticism for price gouging and the likes. So I think this pandemic has given the opportunity to really, I think, show a different face. And AstraZeneca is publishing its full year numbers. They have gone on a recent acquisition spree. They paid $39 billion for Alexion to try and improve their immunology offering. As you say, they've been at the forefront of the vaccine against COVID-19, as well as any variants thereof. Joint venture with Oxford University, I think we can all agree, has been a success story, no matter how European politicians want to spin it with respect to its efficacy on the over 65s. And I expect a fairly decent set of numbers. Full year revenues expected to rise 8.4% to $26.4 billion.
Good news for them. Worth noting, of course, the vaccine's still at this point still being done not for profit by AstraZeneca.
I think that's the key thing, though. I think AstraZeneca is getting a bit of a bad rap on this, and an awful lot of it is political. And I think that's increasingly disappointing for European leaders to talk about efficacy rates, particularly at a time when there's high degrees of vaccine scepticism. I think it's highly irresponsible.
Yeah, I thought it was particularly striking to see. Obviously, dangerous to editorialise on my side of the fence. But yeah, I thought it was remarkable that Emmanuel Macron, of all people, has been leading the charge on this when France, by any measure, any polling, they're going to have a real problem persuading certain parts of their population, both age-wise as well as you know, through ethnography, to get jabs in the arm. I thought it was quite irresponsible, really, all things considered. Interesting sort of pandemic-influenced firm as well. Ocado will be in the headlines this week, probably, we think, for good reasons, or are you shifting a different way?
Well, I think I'm torn about Ocado because really it's a question of whether or not you view it as a retailer or a technology provider. Now, obviously, the recent deal with Marks and Spencer's is delivering, you know, it's delivering considerable benefits. Retail revenue grew 52% in the most recent quarter, rising to £587.3 million. Average orders per week were higher. Q4 saw a rise of 35% retail revenue. So these four-year numbers should be win-win for Ocado. Okay, and they've just recently signed two deals costing a combined $287 million with robotics companies in order to improve their packaging processes. The big concern that I have about Ocado is its valuation. Now, it's got a market cap in excess of £20 billion on revenues around about £2.3 billion. And this is where the description or how you describe it becomes a bit of an issue. Because if it's seen as a supermarket retailer, it's the second biggest food retailer in the UK behind Tesco's, which has a market cap of 26 billion and turns over 65 billion pounds a year. And yet you've got Ocado, which only turns over 2 billion pounds a year. So I think it really depends on whether or not you think it's frothy in terms of being a supermarket retailer, or whether you actually think it's a technology provider. Nonetheless, the shares are near all-time highs. The big question for me is whether it's worth what the market says it is.
Yeah, well, certainly Ocado would like us all to think of them as a tech firm. Keeping it short and sweet, much like the platform, Twitter this week, we've got updates. They, for a long time, Twitter still struggling really to, you know, sort of took over the world in some ways, but monetization has always been the question. They've obviously also got now political headwinds like never before after they kind of announced themselves as publishers with the way they dealt with the last few weeks of President Trump's administration. What are you expecting from them this week?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, Twitter's always had an issue with monetizing its user base, and in Q2 and Q3, number of new users flatlined to around about 187 million daily users. So I think for me, it's really about, do they actually manage to hold that line in Q4, or do they lose users as a result of the spat at the beginning of this year, along with Facebook, with respect to the ban on President Trump? Ultimately, for me, in terms of the optics, it came across as very political because they've had the last 4 years to ban President Trump, only they decide to do it when he's running out his presidential term. And I think as a result of that, as well as an awful lot of ad pull from an awful lot of big companies, these numbers could actually disappoint. So I would suggest that profits are expected to come in around about, well, markets are expecting around about 30 cents a share. I think that's way too optimistic. I think they could miss on that.
Well, yeah, well, that'd be an interesting, to see how they respond over the coming years, because not only is there political pressures, not only is their kind of biggest draw in some way, President Trump, no longer on the platform, there are a lot of people, social media analysts, looking at Twitter and seeing that plateau that you pointed to and wondering, you know, we all thought MySpace 15 years ago was going to run the world. Maybe Twitter could be one of those that 10 years time we all look back on in a sort of quaint world of years past. Michael, thanks so much for joining us. We'll speak to you again soon.
Thank you. Cheers. Thanks, Andy.
And Emma joins me now. Emma, hope you're well. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for asking me.
I think it's fair to say when you took the job, you probably didn't think it was going to be quite as interesting, and I use that phrase deliberately, as it has turned out. But just thinking about the last few months, really the last year, there's a sort of impression, I guess, that all businesses have had to deal with the pandemic equally. Everybody had a tough time, etc., etc. But parking the fact that hospitality throughout the pandemic has had to face, you know, a unique set of challenges. Fundamentally, it relies on people being hospitable to each other, which we've been sort of banned from doing for much of the past 12 months. But the beer and pub industry in particular went into the pandemic almost one hand tied behind its back to a degree, because we've spoken before in print about things like business rates, beer duty, etc. So already the environment, I suppose, for the booze industry, for want of a better phrase, was pretty tough before COVID-19, right?
It was. And now we hear about business rates and VAT being mentioned all the time as part of recovery. But actually, it was already something that we were talking about for the beer and the pub sector as one of the most heavily taxed sectors that we have in the United Kingdom. And for our brewers, it absolutely is the most heavily taxed sector. And when you look at business rates alone, the reason why it's so significant to pubs, and it will be even as we move forward through reopening and recovery, is, you know, we're paying five times more based off of our turnover than any other sector. So that we have a very serious situation right now, but we had one as we were entering into this pandemic, and it is where you started from. You know, if your business was well-financed, if you were in a solid position going into this pandemic, you had a better chance of coming out the other side of it. But the same for us, we were under a massive tax burden. You know, every single penny was hard fought for in hospitality, and particularly in the pub sector, where you have to work doubly hard. And it was our people that put in the efforts to create that thriving pub sector. So we desperately want to, yes, get back open, but let's address the issues that we had that were holding us back before that we absolutely need taken away now in order to get the renaissance that we want.
Yeah, no, I think that's it's a salient point, and one that shouldn't be forgotten is how tough things were anyway. And, you know, we both attended Long Live the Local events, you know, even before that when pubs were closing at an alarming rate. And no doubt that's increased. Do you want to just give us a kind of quick, not recap of the last year, but just give us a kind of situation report? Because everybody knows hospitality's had a tough time. Everybody knows that, you know, it's been uniquely affected, as I said. But there will be people who are thinking about furlough schemes and bounce back loans, et cetera, and saying, well, hang on, you know, surely these pubs will just use those and survive to the other end. But that's not, or has that been the case, or is that not the case? Because my instinct is it's probably the latter.
Well, listen, we are grateful to have received the support that we have as a sector, but it doesn't cover all of the fixed costs that we have within the industry. And so we're looking at a cash burn effect that we very conservatively estimate to be at least 150 million a month. But I have some members that will be burning, you know, 30, 35, 40 million a month. And so it really is something that is building up in the background, this level of debt, the losses that they've had, the inability to trade their way out of it. And so we are simply asking the government, you know, if you want the pub to still be there, we're going to need continued support through this period of closure and throughout the reopening phase as we bring back our customers, we win back their confidence. But also, we may be operating under a phased approach, as they're calling it now, for some time. All of the restrictions that we've put in place to create those safe workplaces and safe environments to socialise have come at an economic cost to us. Even to open our doors in July, we were down 30 to 40% just on capacity and that reduction before we even opened. So if you look at everything else that was layered on top, it is almost impossible for these businesses to actually make a profit and become viable. And so we're fighting for our very existence right now. So the money that's coming in is to make sure that we can protect our business model, and we need more to protect the business model. But then we're going to need more incentives to help us get through any further restrictions that may still remain in place.
It's interesting you say that. I think it's one of the things that was underreported was the amount of money that was spent by small, often independent publicans to make their pubs still appealing going through the restrictions, try and do the best they could with the restrictions. I remember pub I used to manage in Kennington, you know, when you could only socialize indoors with your household, I think it was, but you could have, you know, six people outside. And it feels like, I mean, trying to remember some of these regulations is itself difficult, so God forbid trying to implement them.
Well, we went over and above to do that, to create that safe place, first and foremost for our staff that we value so very highly, but also for our customers. You know, we took a great amount of pride and detail and investment that we put in. 500 million we invested over that period in order to make sure that our venues were safe and that we could operate with those restrictions in place. And yet we saw, again, time and time again, more and more restrictions layered on us in the pub sector, where we were specifically singled out in restrictions for our wet leads in particular, with things like the substantial meal, which meant that, you know, 2/3 of our venues pretty much couldn't open. And the reality being is that other sectors, I have to say, weren't given quite the same high bar that we had to reach, even just to get open.
Yeah, I mean, I do recall walking past shop pubs in that sort of period in December where, quote unquote, non-essential retail was open and pubs were shut. You know, you saw these pictures on Carnaby Street of people going shopping pre-Christmas. And the only business that was shut on the street was the pub, which was the, you know, the pub that had spent probably the most on, you know, making it COVID secure, and in some cases, you know, making them not entirely hospitable places sometimes because of all the screens and everything, but just trying to stay open, trying to survive. It did seem like you were, as a sector, kind of given a bit of a kicking. I don't want to talk about the past too much because we can talk a bit about recovery and reopening and all that jazz, but there must have been, you know, moments during the year where you saw the kind of innovation and pragmatism of the industry come together, not just in making pubs secure, but in brewers doing little mini kegs and stuff. There have been those kind of, not success stories, because I don't think anyone's had a success over the past 12 years, but those stories of innovation and resilience must have been quite heartening for the sector at large as you all tried to get through it together.
Well, in this, you know, this biggest crisis to hit us, the industry, and in extremely dark moments where people don't even know if they'll be able to continue to keep their pub going throughout this crisis, keep a roof above their heads and support their families, it has been really heartwarming. You know, pubs are at the heart of our communities and they really love serving those communities. And so when they were told that they couldn't open and operate as a pub normally would, they thought, how else can we support our communities? And it's phenomenal what they've done in terms of turning into shops, supporting where there is no facilities, particularly for vulnerable areas, turning into takeaway deliveries, providing those kind of services, and then holding digital online events to keep that connectedness there, even though you can't meet in the pub, you know, having your online virtual pub quiz to keep them there and looking after the people that they know come, because that's the only conversation they have for the day. So checking in on customers that they know that live alone, that perhaps are feeling even more isolated throughout this period of time. You know, and that's what pubs do. We're there to celebrate life. We're there to come together as a community, but we're there to support one another. And I hope that we'll still find pubs able to do that and able to see themselves through this crisis to provide that service. It's so valuable.
And those pubs that have, you know, the pubs have had to, it's kind of alluding to what you said at the start, pubs have had to innovate for decades now. You know, once margins on beer in particular got squeezed so hard, you know, you had pubs turning into very good restaurants, everybody had to have a good food offering, you had the pubs that were, you know, knocking through the rooms upstairs that used to be for Aussies coming over for 2 years to work behind the bar and turning them into boutique luxury hotels. So there has been that innovation. It's so so painful then to see 2020 happen, the start of 2021. But let's look to the future with, I hope, you know, a bit of optimism. I know everybody's looking forward to that first pint. We don't really seem to know when that will be. And again, we're at that stage, I think, well, you'll know better than me. It feels like we're at that stage that we were at in sort of April, well, probably May last year, of headlines on a day-to-day basis, briefings from government about what might be open and what might not be open, when it'll be open, when it won't be open. You know, are you and your members just in a world of confusion right now, or are you able to start seeing some light at the end of the tunnel?
Oh, we are definitely in speculation season again. And I really do hope that this is the very last one that we're ever going to experience of this. Are we going to open? Are we not going to open? How are we going to open? Are we going to open with non-essential retail? Are we going to be at the back of the queue again? Are we going to have new restrictions coming into place? All of this is swirling around these people that are absolutely the end of their resources. You know, that they don't know if they'll be able to make it through, and speculation about, will we get to open at Easter? Will we be able to open in May? Or even could it be later than June? It adds an awful lot of stress onto people. And I think, you know, from a mental health position, you know, this is also something that I would say about the speculation and not sharing information if you know it, is people need to plan for their businesses, but they also are dealing with emotional pressures. And it isn't very helpful, I have to say, particularly for also our employees in the sector, to be reading the newspapers every day. You know, that's their jobs that they're talking about. That's their livelihoods. And we need to be able to share and help them through this crisis as much with sharing information and detail that is actually going to happen rather than this continued speculation. But it is enormously difficult right now. And we are working with the government to try and figure out how we can reopen and when is the right time for us to do that. But of course, there's always a lot of reticence when it comes to actually pinning down timelines, dates, and details.
Of course, yeah. And I mean, and looking forward, let's say it seems that the one thing we can be relatively confident about is that it seems that we're moving away from regional restrictions, at least within countries, as and when the reopening happens. You know, what else can, obviously with Chancellor standing up in a budget in about a month's time, you know, what else other than just saying you can trade again, which shouldn't be a good news thing from government, but we live in extraordinary times. You know, what else can the Chancellor do to support you in the reopening? And I guess the other thing is, the second part of that question is, what the industry has actually worked together quite well, I think, over the past year. You know, pub co's took an awful lot of a battering for many, many years in the media. Some of it deserved, some of it not. But they really did seem to work. I'm thinking about Star and various others, work quite well with landlords over the pandemic on rent breaks, et cetera, accepting that the industry was in it together. So, you know, what more can they do? How better can the industry work together through the recovery to make sure that everybody stays alive, that a rising tide lifts all boats? And yeah, again, that first question, what are you pestering the Chancellor to do in March?
Well, the good news is, as a sector, we are pulling together and standing up as hospitality and saying, you know, you cannot continue to give us this disproportionate share of the burden. There has to be fairness in the system. We must be recognized for the efforts that we're going into, the money that we've invested to create safe environments. And that's what we're asking for as we move forward is fairness and clarity on how we can do that, and allowing us to see this as an exercise, as a real reopening of the economy in a post-vaccine world, where we can look at a relaxation and a return to normality. This has to be a de-escalation out of this COVID and out of this pandemic. And that's what we're asking for when it comes to reopening. It has to be a true reopening. We have to be able to trade viably and be able to turn some kind of profit. And the tier system that we had before was not working. It did not deliver that opportunity, and we have to find the right way forward right now. So we are working very hard to do that and make sure that we get the right conditions for us to open. The consequence of that, of course, for the Chancellor will be if we don't get to a point where we can trade and make a profit, then we will need continued support for the long term in terms of those pubs that actually will remain closed if they cannot open, or those that actually say, I cannot open because it's economically inviable for me to do so. So the Chancellor, though, when he's making that speech on the 3rd of March, you know, we would have waited a very long time for things that he could have perhaps announced ahead of that. If he had chosen to do so, that would have helped the sector. What would have helped the sector? Announcing that we were going to see an extension of business rates relief, and also that discount on VAT would also be extended. Those are things that would give confidence to the sector, would indicate that the government is going to continue to invest in the recovery of this sector for the long haul, and make sure that the people that are supporting us in keeping our businesses afloat continue to do so. Beyond that, we also need to look at where that VAT discount has been beneficial. Frankly, it hasn't been operational for many months because we haven't been open to take advantage of it. So there is a big argument to say that it should be extended. But of course, our wet-led pubs, some of the hardest hit people out there, you know, they weren't able to take advantage of that because it didn't include alcoholic beverages. So we've asked for an extension of that to also include them so that everybody in the sector gets a chance to benefit from that incentive to help them recover. And when it comes to looking at how we can help the pub and also help our brewers, is looking at beer duty. We pay 11 times more beer duty in the United Kingdom than they do in Germany and other countries. We are the second highest in Europe, and we absolutely need to be tackling this head on, particularly in a post-Brexit environment, and giving a duty cut to our brewers that have had no route to market open other than the small business that they do through the off-trade, but also online. But many of our brewers, you know, they were 98% through the pubs, and that whole route to market is cut off. No support has been given to those pubs other than a discretionary loan at this stage. There is a fund in Scotland, but nothing in England and Wales. So we would encourage them to look at a duty cut. That would be the easiest way to help them and also help our pubs, where 7 out of 10 alcoholic drinks sold in the pub is a pint of beer. And we all need a pint of beer, I can tell you, at the end of this. So we will need long-term reform. And that will be going back to the very first question, though, which is how can we help the sector recover? It's not just about the here and now. It's about making sure we've got a vibrant scene, a vibrant pub and a vibrant brewing community that will continue long into the future, and that we can continue to have a very, very proud reputation when it comes to the Great British Pub and a great pint of beer.
And on that optimistic note, I think we should leave it. You're absolutely right, Emma. I mean, it's not just planning to reopen as well, because I'm just thinking of some of my favourite pubs and places that I would go for a pint. And, you know, they are places that you would go to before you went to the theatre or before you went to the football. And, you know, those kind of things need to be made clear as well, because that will affect, of course, when those pubs can reopen, not because they're allowed to open their doors, but when it becomes economically viable to have that business there. So a lot of challenges ahead for government, but not nearly as many as for your sector. I think many of us will wish the brewers and the publicans, and you, plenty of luck over the years to come.
That's great. Thanks so much.
Speak soon. That's all from us on the City View with CMC Markets this week. Do catch up next week. That was the City View podcast in partnership with CMC Markets. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. And in the meantime, all the news, analysis and opinion you need will be on cityam.com.
CMC Markets is a pioneering CFD and spread betting provider. With more than 30 years of experience, CMC Markets provides traders with the tools they need to trade confidently. 76% of retail investor accounts lose money.